I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Higher Education to order for Monday, March 19th. And we have several bills in front of us today. And first, I would like to start with Senator Rest with Senate File 1781. Senator Rest, whenever you're ready, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 1781 addresses a relationship between the University of Minnesota and HCMC. And what the bill does, and I do have an author's amendment, is to continue to require the pass-through dollars to support the family practitioner medical education program that HCMC does, essentially for the University of Minnesota. So, Madam Chair, if someone would be so kind, I have the A1 amendment that Council informs us is the correct way to approach this issue.
And Senator Ress, we are waiting just a few minutes for a quorum. So if you'd like to discuss it, then as soon as we get a quorum, we'll pop it on, since it is an author's amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can go right to our witnesses to describe the program, to describe the obligation, and also to put a face on the program. We have one of the graduates of the program here. So if I could ask Dr. Belzer and Dr. Rapaz to come forward, if you could hear their testimony, then we could get back to the author's amendment after that.
Certainly, that would be wonderful. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, both of you, and please just identify yourself for the record and begin whenever you're ready.
My name is Michael Belzer. I'm the Chief Medical Officer of Hennepin County Medical Center. Madam Chair and members of the committee, additionally, besides being the Chief Medical Officer at Hennepin County Medical Center, I also function as an Associate Dean at the University of Minnesota Medical School. I graduated from that medical school, and it's the medical school that I serve and love. And I'm here to testify today in strong support of Senate File 1781, and specifically the wording to preserving the well-deserved long-standing funding stream for the Hennepin County Medical Center Family Medicine Training Program that is a pass-through from the University of Minnesota to our campus. During the brief testimony, I plan to make several points. First, the legislative intent of this appropriation was extremely clear, and that this was to fund a specific family medicine training program at Hennepin County Medical Center. Second, we've had a 41-year consecutive history of receiving this appropriation from the university. Third, on several well-documented occasions, the University Medical School has attempted to withhold payment from the Hennepin County Medical Center Family Medicine Program, and in each and every occasion, the legislature, following clear guidance by your own legislative analysts, have confirmed and corroborated the intent and refused to allow the university to withhold the payment. Fourth, we're not asking for any new funding. And five, our residents continue to practice in Minnesota after graduation, and well over 225 of our residents practice in virtually every county in our state. Our hospital is celebrating its 135th anniversary this year. We are a state resource for Minnesota's oldest and largest safety net hospital with a commitment to educate professionals, not only physicians. We train professionals in over 30 healthcare disciplines that serve the state well. In any given year, we train 20,000 individuals in their respective healthcare fields, including RNs, physician assistants, pharmacists, emergency medicine technicians, radiology technicians, laboratory techs, and for the vast majority of these programs that we have contracts with local colleges, we receive no stipend for their training. We've been called one of the few healthcare professional factories for the state of Minnesota. Regarding our MD residency programs, we've documented and looked at where our residents practice after graduation, and 67% of our residents at Hennepin County Medical Center, including the family practice residents, stay in the state and set up practice in Minnesota. Our family practice residents can be found in virtually every county in the state. If the state legislature was very wise to provide appropriate funding for this particular program since 1969, and If we do the simple math, we graduate at least 10 residents each year. So if we took a 10 residents a year times 40 years times the 65% retention of our residents in the state, over 250 family practice physicians who trained at Hennepin County Medical Center stay in the state of Minnesota and provide services to our citizens. I'm sure you're aware that family practice and primary care physicians are an endangered species. The national shortage of primary care and family medicine physicians is very well documented, and Minnesota is no exception. We feel strongly that this is not the time to eliminate funding for a well-established family medicine program when it jeopardizes the existence of a 35-year program. For background, state funding appropriation for family practice residencies often flow through the university as a pass-through, and that is the case for Hennepin and other programs like St. Cloud. The history of the family medicine state appropriation payments flowing through the university has been the case since 1969, when the university first reported it as a special. Starting in 1981, as often the case, the legislature folded the graduate training program dollars into the university O&M appropriation, which we refer to as the base funding to the university. When rolled into the university base, as you're aware, the legislative requirement for the biennial reporting was deleted, and in 1983, the requirement from the pass-through for the pass-through was questioned. The following opinion was obtained in a written document, and let me quote, however, even though the funding was rolled into the base, there was a clear understanding between the legislature and the university that the university would continue to distribute the appropriated funds to Hennepin and the other hospitals following the established pattern. This was a quote from a formal document signed by Mrs. Tricia Grimes, who was a legislative fiscal analyst from the House Appropriations Committee. In 2009, the medical school once again proposed to eliminate funding for the pass-through for this program, citing financial concerns. Their explanation was that since the pass-through funding was rolled into the University of Minnesota base, that they did not need to pass it on to Hennepin County Medical Center. We, of course, disagreed once again and appealed to the funding source, you, and to this committee. And we met with the higher education leadership and asked them to investigate the history of the legislative intent and payments. However, first we sought an opinion from a former state legislator, Howard Ornstein, who was the higher ed finance division member from, he served in the legislature from 1987 to 1996. And Mr. Ornstein felt that the 40-year history, the Grimes opinion, and the paper trail all supported the Hennepin opinion that the pass-through should be directed to Hennepin County Medical Center. In this committee, your research analyst, Maya Wedman, at the request of Senator Pappas and the Higher Ed Committee, reviewed the long history, documented the historical payments, and came to the same conclusion that Tricia Grimes did 27 years earlier, that the funding should be directed to Hennepin County Medical Center. And she also supported the opinion that the appropriation was in the base and did not need to be called out each successful biennium. So fast forward to the present. Here we are again. The medical school once again ceased payments as of 8 months ago to Hennepin County Medical Center, again citing the same argument that there's no call out by the legislature to specifically direct it to Hennepin County Medical Center. We feel that this is the same argument we've received opinions on before. And although the medical school is citing a financial crisis, we believe that their finances are reasonably sound, and I'm proud to say that. The medical school cited an annual revenue increase of 5.8 to 9.6% for the past 7 years, and they quoted positive operating margins for the medical school in 6 of the past 8 years. So, in conclusion, we're not asking for any additional funding. We believe that the legislative intent of this appropriation was and is clear, that is designated for funding a specific program, Hennepin County Medical Center Family and Medicine Program, not the medical school or academic health sciences. Hennepin has been receiving this appropriation every year since 1969, and the fact that the appropriation was rolled into the university O&M base does not free the university from passing this appropriation through to Hennepin County Medical Center. On the several occasions the university has attempted to withhold payment, we've appealed to the funding source, this committee, for an opinion and decision, and House and Senate research analysts have come to the same conclusion that there was a clear understanding between the legislature and the university that the university would continue to distribute the appropriate funds to Hennepin and other hospitals following the established pattern. And that opinion was backed by a writer in the 210 session, as you know. And without funding, Hennepin will need to pare back or eliminate this very important Hennepin County Medical Center Family and Medicine Program, which would provide numerous future family medicine physicians across our state. And so even though I admire and respect the university and their leadership, Dean Friedman is a valued colleague, I think that this decision, which has been enacted to withhold funding from Hennepin, flies in the face of a 40-year history of sustained funding, your legislative research analysts' opinions, and legislative action in the past. So we strongly urge you to support the wording in Senate File 1781. And just let me introduce a colleague, Dr. Rachel Rapaz, and let me tell you that we contacted four of our previous family and community medicine residents who are practicing in the state, and let me just give you their names and where they practice before I turn this over to Dr. Rapaz. One is Dr. Jeff Mellon, who has spent 10 years in a family medicine clinic and 12 years in Northfield, Minnesota. Dr. Kirk Sermons, who is a 2007 graduate, who works in Monticello, Minnesota. He also has privileges in Roseau, Thief River Falls, Crookston, Two Harbors, Aiken, Onamia, Mora, Monticello, Litchfield, Hutchinson, and St. Peter. Dr. Rachel Rapaz, who graduated in 2007, who will tell you her story. And then finally, Dr. Thomas Bracken, who sent this statement. Let me read it briefly before Dr. Rapaz talks. I graduated from the University of Minnesota Medical School in 1979. I was privileged to enter the family practice residency at Hennepin and was there from 1979 until I graduated in 1982. The Hennepin County Medical Center Family Medicine Program was an excellent training program for me with experience in all areas of family medicine, including their Level 1 Emergency Department and outstanding obstetric service. This training prepared me very well for rural medicine. I have served as a family physician in the rural community of Onamia for 29 years. My fellow family physicians and I are the only physicians for 20 miles in any direction. Since 1984, I've served as a community staff preceptor for family medicine residents from the program at Hennepin. We've trained hundreds of family physicians, many of whom have gone on to serve in both rural and urban Minnesota. We were delighted to recently offer one of these senior residents from the Hennepin program a position at our rural healthcare system. We are now noting the dramatic decrease in the availability of family physicians in rural areas, having lost one physician, and we've been recruiting for over a year with just two candidates. The Hennepin County Medical Center Family Medicine Program is vitally needed to continue to supply family physicians for Minnesota in the years to come, end quotes. So, Madam Chair and committee members, thank you very much. And let me introduce Dr. Rachel Rapaz.
Before we do that, I would like to declare that we do have quorum. And I would like to put on that A1 amendment, that author's amendment. I believe Senator Eaton wanted to offer that amendment. Members, there's A1 author's amendment that I believe is in your packets that Senator Rest wanted put on the bill. So all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Please, Doctor, go ahead.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Rachel Rapaz. I am a 2007 graduate of the HCMC Family and Community Medicine Residency, and I've been a member of the faculty since 2009. I'm here to share my story and ask for your support of SF 1781 so that HCMC-trained family medicine residents can continue to be trained to provide excellent care for Minnesotans across the state. My own father was a family and emergency medicine physician who worked in Midwestern communities with populations from 5 to 40,000 people, and he eventually went on to teach new residents as the head of a residency program. I wanted to become a family medicine physician because I, too, wanted to work with all kinds of patients and to provide that full spectrum of family medicine care. I wanted to attend births and provide preventative care to care for chronic medical conditions like asthma, diabetes, and addiction, to do procedures and set fractures. I went to medical school at the University of Minnesota, where I chose numerous clinical rotations at HCMC, including sleep medicine, internal medicine, endocrinology, and a four-month extended family medicine rotation in what is now the HCMC Eastlake Clinic. Upon graduating from medical school, HCMC was my first choice for residency training. Residency training, as I'm sure you know, is the period following medical school when a physician gets in-depth training in his or her area of specialty, in my case, family medicine. The program at HCMC is a 3-year comprehensive residency which focuses on preventative care and emphasizes treating the whole person and the whole family, not just isolated medical conditions. It also takes very seriously its mission to provide excellent care for all people, not just patients with private insurance. When I graduated from the HCMC Family Medicine Residency Program, I chose to work in outstate Minnesota. I cared for people's asthma and their diabetes, their anxiety and their addiction. I sewed up their lacerations, and I set their fractures. I spoke with their families about what was going on when they were too... Sorry. When they were too ill to do so. And I stabilized them, and I got them safely to hospitals that could provide higher-level treatment if that was what they needed. I felt confident practicing in rural settings because I was so well-trained at HCMC. I could care for everyone, from newborns to the elderly, and provide comprehensive care of everything, from routine chronic conditions to emergency care. Several of my other residency classmates went outstate to practice comprehensive medical care as well, including Kevin Sermons, who is an excellent physician. I practiced in Greater Minnesota for nearly 2 years, primarily in Two Harbors Lakeview Hospital and Grand Marais North Shore Hospital, but also in Crosby and Cook. Among many stories that come to mind, in which I felt that my HCMC training made a real difference, I'll share two with you briefly. One is about a woman in Cook, Minnesota, who had a stroke. Thanks to my training, I was able to recognize her symptoms. I was able to interpret the radiologic tests without having to wait for the official radiology overread, and I was able to quickly call Life Flight to transport her to a facility where she could receive clot-busting drugs to save her life and preserve her function. When you're practicing in rural areas, far from larger facilities with services for stroke management, and the clock is running, it makes a difference if there is a doctor who can make the right call and get the patient to treatment in a quick fashion. The second story that I'll tell you is about a young woman in Two Harbors, Minnesota. For years, she had been coming into the emergency room in crisis for her severe asthma, and that was her primary source of primary care. Sometimes in the emergency room, you are that person's primary care provider. As I worked with her and I taught her ways to better manage her symptoms with daily controller medications, to recognize her own symptoms and quickly manage her flare-ups, I saw that over time she had fewer crises and she was making fewer trips to the ER. There were many other patients' health and lives made better in this way, and their medical care was far less costly and saved money for themselves and for their communities. HCMC is a very unique place. I fell in love with HCMC, with its diverse population and with the diverse group of highly skilled and passionate physicians who work and teach there when I was in medical school, and that's why I chose to go there for residency. The residency training at HCMC qualifies its graduates to take jobs anywhere in our state, in all kinds of settings. Fully a third of our graduates practice in rural settings, another third practice in urban settings, and another third in suburban settings. We can work anywhere we feel called to work, from an emergency room to a clinic to a birth center. In 2007, I chose to return to HCMC and the Family Medicine Residency Program as faculty. I now work at the Brooklyn Park Clinic and downtown at HCMC, where I take care of patients and attend births and teach residents and students. I feel that as an HCMC residency graduate, I always felt well qualified to work in outstate clinics and emergency rooms, and I've encouraged other residents to look for opportunities to do that during residency and after residency. In conclusion, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I urge you to support SF 1781 and support the HCMC Family Medicine Residency Training Program so that it can continue to train highly qualified physicians to care for patients across Minnesota. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on the bill? The two doctors are the only folks I had. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I came in a little late, but I'm just wondering, did someone testify as to how many residents this is serving and what the $645,000 means to each of those as they're getting trained in their program?
Dr. Belzer?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator, the family practice residency has anywhere from 10 to 12 residents each year, and it's a three-year program. So typically in any given year, there are 30 or 36 residents training. I believe there are 30 residents training now. In addition to the stipend pass-through through the University of Minnesota, Medicare and to some extent Medicaid also funds graduate medical education by embedding a payment amount into the prospective payment system to help teaching hospitals train residents. All teaching hospitals, for at least the ones I'm familiar with, the training programs run at a deficit. In other words, the revenue never supports the cost of the resident, the stipend, the benefits, the teaching costs, the food, and the training. So it's hard to say exactly where this $460,000 tracks to, but it does support 30 residents in a three-year training program.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering if the university is going to present their side of the story.
Senator Pappas, I do not have anyone on that wanted to testify other than Mr. Bach who from the U of M who would be willing to answer questions. Specific questions, so.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Terry Bach. I'm Associate Vice President of Health Sciences at the University of Minnesota. We're certainly here to we support funding of family practice, and the issue has, as we have tried to deal with funding issues, has been because of the serious cuts in state funding that we've had at the medical school, almost $14 million over the last 3 years. So it's not an issue about the quality of the family practice program or our support of the need of that. In fact, we've been trying there's a broader issue facing the state, and that is the funding of family practice training sites and primary care sites across the state. And we need to really take a much more comprehensive look at that, hopefully during the interim, about how you deal with the shortfall that we have in Medicare and Medicaid funding, in the medical education research state funding that's been used in clinical training, as well as these state specials.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Bach, we definitely understand that there have been significant cuts to the university in the O&M budget and also in Merck. And it seems to me a reasonable compromise here would have been to, rather than eliminate funding for HCMC, is just to pass on the cuts to HCMC. And I think you might not be here now if you kind of negotiated that situation, because I think both sides, you know, I'm sure they can be reasonable and understand that it's a bigger problem, a bigger picture. So, So why didn't that happen?
Mr. Bach.
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, as we read the legislation, the language in the state special is very prescriptive about what actually the money can be spent on, and that we didn't have the discretion within the state special to do that. So with this language, what we will do is pass on the money to Hennepin County Medical Center for the Family Practice Program, and we'll take proportionate cuts in the other programs to fund that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
But I think the amendment is no longer taking it out of health sciences, where there is an appropriation there for the St. Cloud Family Presidency Program, which is the University of Minnesota program. My question is, and the delete all says it's just coming out of operation and maintenance. So were you aware of the A1 amendment?
I'm trying to. My understanding had been that that was an appropriate, that was a cut to the state special, but.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, we Center were informed rest. By counsel that the better language, this was language suggested to us by Senate counsel to accomplish that pass-through purpose, and that what was in the original bill was not an appropriate way of doing that. So we took the advice of counsel and then offered this amendment, which the committee is a more appropriate way of accomplishing the goal. And I would just point out that, as has been testified to so eloquently, that this is something that's been going on for 40 years, and that this is not something new. This is not an addition. This is an understood pass-through that has been, verified on any number of occasions and ratified then by the legislature. If this pass-through is not there, the program certainly is in jeopardy. I don't think that any of you would think that the property taxpayers of Hennepin County ought to support this this program as opposed to coming through this pass-through amount that's been passed through for some 40 years at an agreed-upon amount that the legislature has supported.
And Senator Pappas, I believe Mr. Fuller had something about the amendment, or am I making that up, Mr. Fuller? But I think you wanted to add a little something about how the determination was made.
There were two flaws in the original bill. It just wasn't structurally right. And so I fixed that. The amendment fixes that. And then there was the issue of the source of money and the specials, which the specials has like $5 million a year. This has $500 million. Once when they were forced to, in 2010, my understanding was to take the money out of specials, cause some hardship for other accounts within that special. But this is out there as a olive branch, I would say, to university to give them more flexibility in taking the money. I suppose if they want to take it from the specials, my guess is Hennepin County would take it from wherever they got it. But that's why the language was changed, because there had been some difficulty. We're late in the fiscal year. There's not a lot of money there. And so I thought it was to give them more flexibility. So there's two aspects of it. That was just thrown in the amendment. The other part of it was fixing it up so it worked.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was my understanding, too, is there's just a bigger pot of money. I think this is, in a sense, like robbing from Peter to pay Paul, though. I think the problem is that the University of Minnesota budget has been cut. The problem is we still need to educate family practice doctors, and they need to have residency slots, and it really is a much bigger problem. And some family practice residencies do get subsidies from us or the university, la la la, and some do not. I think there's one up in Duluth that hasn't gotten any subsidy. I'm not sure how they're operating. And we do fund United Family Practice through the Office of Higher Education. So I think it might be wise for staff and the committee to take a look at exactly how all the family practice programs in the state, and if we think as a higher ed committee that this is a priority to kind of figure out a real kind of fair and equal way to subsidize them all.
Further discussion on Senate File 1781 as amended. Senator Rest, the intention is to lay it over for possible inclusion, if that's all right with you.
Absolutely.
Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on the bill? Any other discussion from the committee? On the motion to, well, Senator Miller, make the motion to lay it over for possible inclusion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Rest, very much. Senator Miller, you have to
All right, members, now we have Senate File 2423 in front of us. Senator Fischbach, welcome
back
to
your
committee.
Thank you very much. You know, it's so nice when you chair because every time you welcome me to the committee, and it's so kind of you.
Madam Chair, I welcome you to your committee.
Mr. Chair, I do have the A1 author's amendment that I'd like to offer.
Okay.
Since it's the first time it's been heard.
Okay. We have the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Fischbach.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Senate File 2423, as amended, contains two separate provisions that are aimed at assisting MNSCU campuses to meet the needs of employers and in every area in the state. First, it establishes a leveraged equipment fund, which will help campuses partner with private industry to bring in new equipment and improve technology in the areas of high employment demand. This approach will allow the public investment to go farther and increase the private engagement and investment in the programs that are important to us in the state. And the dollars need to be matched with non-state dollars, so it makes it go even further than our state dollars are able to. The second provision provides an appropriation to MNSCU to assist in an effort to better align educational offerings with the needs of employers. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I believe that these two provisions will allow MNSCU to continue its mission of meeting the direct workforce needs in the state of Minnesota. And I do have with me President Johnson, who will be able to speak more about.
My very good friend, President Johnson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. What do I call you? Interim chair?
Just a minute. That seemed much heartier. His welcome seemed much nicer than mine. I want a redo. No. I'm sorry.
President Johnson, welcome. Just state your name for the record, please.
Jim Johnson. I am president of Minnesota State College Southeast Technical with campuses in Red Wing and Winona. And I am pleased to be able to come to before you today to talk a little bit about this proposed amendment, Senate File 2423. As I was around in 99 when the last time this was implemented, and I think that is a as a technical college president, I think that one of these types of activities and programs in which we were able to leverage about 3 to 1 for every state dollar, about $3 in not only college or university dollars, but also private dollars. I think it's a good investment. And in essence, it's got some very positive outcomes. Focused on students, it allows our students to deal with updated and critical technology that at certain times we as institutions are not able to basically put forth in our budgets. But it does force us then to partner with businesses and industry to truly collaborate, to develop those partnerships that focus on what is really needed out there in the workforce, whether it's at university graduates, community college graduates, or technical college graduates. Basically, it allows us then to, as well, as we partner, to be able to upgrade our instructional equipment to improve the educational process for those students. One of the tenets of my tenure is always to, I've been at the college since 1981 and seen a lot of people come and a lot of people go. But one of the things that we are very proud of at Southeast Tech is that when our graduates graduate and walk across that stage, which will be this May, they will be ready, for the most part, to be very productive in the workforce immediately. They aren't going to be tradesmen or journeymen right off the bat, but they will be productive for those specific institutions that they will go to. And it's no different. We're 94% placement rate, so they are going to be out in the workforce very quickly. This type of program allows us to be able to access additional dollars. An example is in the 99 bill, Ridgewater was able to access dollars and purchase simulators for their health program that they would not most likely have been able to purchase during that critical time. Alexandria Technical College and Community College, automotive and then auto motion control devices were also purchased. Again, leveraged almost at a three times what the allocation was. WSU, Winona State University, gas chromatographs for their science programs. St. Cloud Technical College, printing equipment and welding equipment and video tech equipment. Three separate grants, but those were all possible as they aligned themselves with those specific businesses. And then again at Dakota, another example is Dakota County Technical College, where they were able to access and leverage dollars for telecommunications equipment. At my college, we were able to leverage about $150,000 worth of auto body equipment, state-of-the-art alignment equipment, as well as specialty tools that would not have been purchased. I can tell you in that probably until the next few years down the line. So what it does, it helps us to absolutely accelerate our equipment purchases. That also helps us to get those students out with current skill sets that the industries are demanding. What also it does for our students, if they've worked on some of this latest, greatest technology, it also helps them to secure that job because they are working on some of the latest technology. I think the value of this program is significant, especially as we struggle, like everybody else, across this state in dwindling support, whether it's legislative appropriation or whether it's actual gifts to the college. All industries are struggling, but this type of leverage sells very well with our business partners and other people that we collaborate with because we're all buying in to this type of expenditure, and it's benefiting people very, very quickly in those programs. The other thing that it helps us do, that we all, there isn't a college president or university president that wants to raise tuition, but it also helps us extend that budget, stretch that budget so that we don't have to come back with exorbitant, or it helps us lessen the sting of tuition increases because we aren't having to pull some of our budget towards equipment purchases. Because it's all comes from one pot, basically. So what it does for the colleges, to be quite honest, it develops peer collaborations and partnerships and strengthens relationships with our MNSCU partners across the state, business, industry, and all other types of collaborations that help us keep our programs viable. It stretches budgets, gives us access to that equipment sooner than later, to get these students out in a critical time, especially if we are able to get this through this time. This is a critical time. We need people that are training right now as this economy comes back, because 2-3 years down the line is going to be too late. It also is going to help us improve again for the colleges and universities that instructional technology and the pedagogy within the classroom. And it'll also help us put together an infrastructure as we partner with our businesses and industries. It'll help us to develop those relationships that we can use down the line to help with donations and other assistance from those critical industry partners. So I think as we, if this goes through and moves forward and is approved, we don't have the total infrastructure yet put in place, but how the prior bill in 99 worked is it was based off an average of what I spent in equipment the prior 2 years and what percentage of that pot I had to then go after the grant to. In other words, I had a certain percentage of that grant dollar I was able to go after. What Chancellor Rosenstone has agreed will do with his staff is work with us presidents as we look at how we can then allocate out these grant dollars, working with the presidents across the state. So I think with that, I'd open it up to questions.
Well, that's up to the chair.
Yes. Thank you, President Johnson.
Mr. Chair, you can ask me a question.
Thank you for the testimony. I have Senator Laurie with a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple of questions, I guess. I'm wondering if you have an idea how much you're hoping to plug in here or just a target amount.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, Senator Laurie, we were thinking $5 million, but we don't know. We are waiting. We are just going to lay this over for possible inclusion and continue see what we can work on.
Senator Laurie?
I've got just a couple of questions, and I should preface it with I like the concept. I have one of these collaborative partnerships up in Cloquet with the paper mill there, and they work very well together and provide a lot of really good employees for Sappi over there. And Sappi's actually putting in a $170 million expansion on their line, and I think that bodes well for that collaboration with the industry partners. And so I am typically in favor of this and plan on supporting it, but the match, there's no percentage on the match or anything, so I'm wondering how the prioritization goes. You said some of them were 3-to-1 matches that you've made with
typically
industry
partners.
President Johnson.
Yes, it had to be a 1-to-1 match, but most of those, the historic figures that we got, it came out to about, for $5 million leveraged, we got $17 million in return. So it was a combination of probably, I don't know the total project, but when I looked at the list, it was probably in the 30, 40 projects that were out there, and they averaged about a 3-to-1 return on the match. So for sure it would have to, most likely, if it was like the 99 program, it would be a 1-to-1 match minimum.
Mm-hmm. Senator Laurie, follow-up?
Yeah, that's fine. It doesn't say it in here. I don't know if we wanted to do that, but I think we can probably trust Rosenstone to prioritize well and pick those ones that we get the most benefit for. But on the A1 amendment, also this one, I was actually trying to figure out exactly how this is tailored to it. It seems kind of a loose fit. I'm not envisioning exactly what this would be used for. It looks like an additional administrative expense to me, rather than kind of a nuts and bolts, boots on the ground type thing for the purpose of aligning programs to meet the needs of employers for a skilled workforce. Maybe we could tease out a little bit more about the purpose of the additional expenditure in the A1 and the amount that you had in mind for this one as well.
Senator Fischbach?
President Johnson.
Chair Miller, Senator Laurie, I can tell you the intent is really to help us facilitate regional meetings, and there'll be somewhere in the tune of 30 to 40 meetings, specifically meeting with business, industry, private, public partners that are talking about, and there have been already, you know, it's kind of following up on what Governor Dayton went around the state, and we hosted one in Winona at our college campus. It's talking with businesses and industries and other interested parties in what is the work skill set that we need to move this state forward and to sustain where we're at. So it's to help us support that activity over the next 3 to 6 months and really to bring that to basically help us fund that.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions for President Johnson from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, President Johnson. We appreciate your testimony. Ms. Wallstein, would you like to testify? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Amy Wallstein. I'm the Director of Education and Workforce Development Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify briefly in support of this bill. At the Chamber of Commerce, we speak to Minnesota businesses every day, and the key things that we're hearing are that, number one, there's a skills gap. The skills that workers have coming into the workforce don't always meet the needs of the employers. And the second thing that we hear is that there's a worker shortage in several key areas, especially in several manufacturing sectors. So what this tells us is that it's important that we align the skills that businesses need with the skills that are being taught at higher education institutions. And it's also important for us to take advantage of opportunities to bring academic and business communities together to talk about their needs and how they can best work together. So we see that this initiative will help facilitate the conversations between local colleges and businesses. And then sitting down to talk about how to best equip the programs, they'll also be talking about how to best meet workforce needs in the local communities. And that'll develop a better understanding of how businesses and academics can work together to prepare a well-trained workforce for Minnesota businesses. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wallstein. Any questions from the committee?
Chair Miller, I'd like to make one other comment if
yes,
I can.
Yes, President Johnson,
I think the importance of these regional and statewide meetings is there isn't a student that we would graduate that we do not want them to be placed, whether it's a university, community college, or technical college, that if we don't talk to the people that are out there buying our services, to be quite honest with you, hiring our graduates, we're remiss in not doing that, and it is so critical in today's world of the changing, where we may have to adjust our curriculum a little bit or tweak it maybe in the advanced stages of that curriculum to stay current with what's going on out there. And I think that's important. This type of activity will be critical for that, for us to be successful.
Very good. Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on Senate File 2423? Any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, Senator Fischbach?
I would move that Senate File 2423 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Okay. Senator Fischbach moves that Senate File 2423 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the Senate Higher Ed Omnibus Bill. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion carries.
Thank you very much.
All right, next on the agenda is Senate File 1531. Senator Olson. Senator Olson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Doesn't seem that long ago that I was here before. It wired here.
No problem.
The Senate File 1531 is a bill that actually was kind of drawn into the discussion of the bill that I had on individualizing education or developing an individualized school. So we made some reference the last time I was here. But this is the focus of 1531 is that, you know, we've talked a lot about students learning in different ways, and we don't always recognize and put into practice that belief. And part of the area that has been diminished in our secondary schools as a result of our pushing for the high standards and high academic standards has been our career tech programs. And many young people do learn better in an applied way. It isn't that they don't learn math and appreciate math. Oftentimes there's been studies that have proven that they do better in some of the math exams as a result of learning it in an applied way, because that's what they are, where their brain is geared, if you will. And we've lost, so we've kind of lost ground in that area, and I often recall. I've been here since Governor Perpich was governor, and I remember clearly him saying he wanted to have a 96% graduation rate by 1996. And the reality is we've gone the other direction. And so we're working to try to get back a high school graduation rate that comes close to matching that. Interestingly enough, in one of the pieces of information that we came across was for the Carl Perkins Core Index on the graduation rate of young people that have participated in career tech programs to the tune of just an hour a day for a year. Now, it may have been in a block program, but is that equivalent? That they have a graduation rate of 97.12%. So Senator Stumpf and I have been on this crusade for a number of years, and we had the hunch that that's part of the reason that we've had an increasing dropout rate and incompletion of the high school graduation was the fact that we were diminishing the opportunities that young people had to participate in it. And so this bill actually is bringing forward the idea, and it's the Center for School Change, and Dr. Nathan has been a key part in developing this, is the recognition of the success of the post-secondary enrollment options program that has not only provided tremendous opportunities for young people to get a head start on college, but it has also pushed the schools into offering more rigorous programs, such as AP courses, International Baccalaureate, College in the Schools. These kinds of things have greatly increased. We, I think, are the fifth fastest growing state in terms of the number of AP courses that are offered in our schools. And it's the idea of having these kinds of opportunities and not necessarily setting high entrance requirements for them has been particularly good for those who are struggling to succeed, including young men as well as low-income students. So what this bill proposes is that that we open the doors for an opportunity taking a sample career tech program. It started out with opening that door to 9th and 10th graders. That was a little more than some could handle for the 9th graders, so we amended an education before it left that committee to just include the 10th graders. So let's walk before we run, and even though we know that there are young people that can handle it, and the current PSEO statute does involve, has got a very clear statement about the importance of the counseling and the parents in decision making as to whether their child can handle whatever the consequences might be in terms of choosing this path. But that is the main part of this proposal, and it. I think I'm going to stop there. I'm going to let Dr. Nathan make some comments, too, about why he has become so interested in this particular issue and this approach.
Very good. Dr. Nathan, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Nathan. I direct the Center for School Change at McAllister College. For 42 years, I've been a public school teacher, administrator, PTA president, member of the state board of the PTA, researcher, writer, and advocate for improved public education in Minnesota. 27 years ago, on a bipartisan basis, people in this building came together to do something very controversial and very fundamental. You said, and your colleagues said, that it was important to allow youngsters in the 11th and 12th grade to try to take courses at the college and university level. This was enormously controversial. One statewide organization said it was the worst piece of legislation passed in the last quarter century. On the other hand, poll after poll has found that since the 27 years have passed, more than 80% of Minnesotans believe this is a good idea, that when youngsters have participated in this program, more than 80% said if they had to do it over again, they would. When the legislative auditor looked at the post-secondary options and surveyed thousands of parents and students, they said the same thing. When the legislative auditor surveyed high school principals, although they weren't particularly fond of the idea, they said that more than half of them said that one of the impacts of post-secondary options was that it increased communication and collaboration between high schools and colleges. Our center recently conducted a study after 25 years to see what's happened with dual credit programs, and that by that I mean advanced placement, international baccalaureate, college in the schools, and Project Lead the Way. We are strongly in favor of more youngsters taking challenging courses. We don't have a bias that post-secondary options or AP or IB are better. We do have a bias that it's better for high school kids to challenge themselves, because we know, unfortunately, that 38% of the youngsters who graduate from Minnesota public schools have to take a remedial course when they graduate from our high schools and go on to some form of public post-secondary education. Now, what can be done? Well, the senator pointed out that we have extensive research, some of it cited in our research, that shows that when youngsters participate in these courses, they're first much more likely to enter some form of higher education, secondly, much more likely to graduate, and third, that this can save youngsters and the taxpayers literally tens of thousands of dollars. Because if youngsters take one or two or five or ten courses during their junior or senior year, they save themselves money, they save their families money, and equally important, they save the taxpayers money if they continue their education here in Minnesota. So we think it's worth noting that once again, thanks to people like Senator Pappas, Senator Olson, and in the House, Representative Greiling, Representative Erickson, once again, the legislature is approached with the opportunity on a bipartisan basis to take one more step forward. This is a step that's been endorsed by the Star Tribune, by the Pioneer Press, by the ECM newspapers. Equally important, it's been endorsed by a variety of community groups throughout the state of Minnesota, the African American Leadership Program, African American Leadership Forum, the Alternative School Association, Dane Smith and Growth and Justice, also the Minnesota Business Partnership, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Across the political spectrum, people have come forward. We've had folks who don't spend their days and nights here at the legislature have come forward to 8 different hearings to say, please consider this modest expansion of opportunity. So there are 4 central advances in this bill over the 1985 bill. First, it opens on a limited basis this opportunity for 10th graders to participate in career technical courses, and these courses are defined. You just heard testimony, very eloquent testimony, about the importance of career and technical education. Couldn't agree more. This says there are some youngsters who are ready for this kind of thing. In the 10th grade, it's not a theory. The Minnesota Council on Gifted and Talented pleaded in earlier hearings for this kind of opportunity for some youngsters. So did the Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs. So did the African American Leadership Forum. So did Growth and Justice. This is a modest expansion of opportunity to 10th graders to take one career technical course, and if they earn at least a C, they would be allowed to take additional courses. But they have to earn at least a C in order to be allowed to take courses. And as Senator Pappas pointed out to me, that's really important. We don't want to set up youngsters for failure. So that's the first. The second part of this is that it says we're going to allow truth and testimony. We're going to allow truth in advertising. For a quarter century, high schools have been allowed to tell youngsters quite accurately that if they participate in AP, IB, Advanced Placement, International Baccalaureate, or Project Lead the Way, or College in the Schools, they can save themselves literally thousands of dollars. And that's perfectly valid. But at one point in the last 25 years, A prohibition was put on colleges and universities, and they were told, you can't tell people this. Well, we're simply removing that prohibition. It's unusual that the legislature would prohibit freedom of speech. It's not like it's yelling fire in a crowded theater to tell families, if your youngster works hard in a post-secondary class, she or he can participate, can earn, can save money. So we think that's a second important thing. Third important thing is that it tells youngsters that they can do the same thing in high school and college. That is to say, they can earn both high school and college credit by participating in this. We think that these are three important steps forward. More importantly, a broad array of citizen and community groups and educators in this state think it's important. We have listened, as Senator Olson said, to concerns that have been raised. It has been modified. It no longer includes ninth graders. It makes it clear that the college and university system does have the right to decide which courses are available to youngsters, whether there are any room in a particular course, or whether the course is available at all. We completely respect and appreciate the fact that colleges and universities can set prerequisites. We completely appreciate the fact that colleges and universities can say, we're going to decide which courses are available. So we think these are three important steps forward, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Dr. Nathan, for your testimony. Any questions? Otherwise, Senator Olson, do we have an amendment?
Yes, we do. I have it here.
A14. Oh, we have a question. Senator Pappas?
Do you want to do the amendment first?
We can do the amendment first.
There's somebody
we get someone to, or I think we have it in our files.
Yeah.
Do you have it?
We have it in our packet, Senator Olson.
I'd move the A14 amendment.
Okay. Senator Pappas moves the A14. Senator Olson, any explanation?
I think we have our fiscal analyst here, too, to explain this, but it essentially removes the fiscal impact by an approach of reducing the rate of the funds that follow the student to the higher ed institution, if I'm not mistaken. So,
Mr. Nauman, would you like to add to that?
Mr. Chair and members, Senator Olson has it almost 100% correct, as usual, but there's a slight permutation. The fiscal note that you have in front of you shows a $14,000 savings, and that amendment was calculated based on a payment to the school district, or to the, sorry, we're a creature of where we spend most of our time. I'm going to fall into saying school district probably too often, but to the higher ed institutions, there's a formula that pays for PSEO students. And that formula, we've got a chart that we can walk you through this on, but the fiscal note made an assumption about an adjustment to the pupil weight factor as opposed to a adjustment at the very end of the calculation. And so the amendment does two things. Number one, it clarifies the proper method for doing the calculation. For that one time, I think it's section, sorry, we're talking about Section 7 in the bill, in the first engrossment. It clarifies how that calculation should be done, and then it makes an adjustment to the 0.6 to 0.5 to balance the bill.
Five, thank you. Five. Any questions from the committee on the A14?
0.55, I believe, is what the A14 says.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
So, I mean, the practical impact of this is that for 1 year, the 10th grade students, the colleges will get reimbursed at a reduced rate if
Sir
they
Nauman?
Choose to take the students. So I don't think it's a really good idea.
For one course.
But it, for one
course.
For their first course.
Well,
Senator Olson, Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, we are adding new pupil eligibility. And so for the first year of their eligibility, for those students, only the 10th grade students we're talking about here are going to get reimbursed at a slightly reduced rate in order to accomplish balance in the bill. And I can crawl into a fair bit of detail on this. I'll try to keep it pretty simple. But when you are, the bill pays for itself internally by reducing pupil counts in the K-12 system and then making a payment out for PSEO participation. The reduction from the lower pupil counts is shifted in the K-12 payment shift. So you only get to recognize 64.3% of that reduction, but then the PSEO payment goes out at 100%.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Nauman, are you saying that it's balanced within this bill or it's balanced within the K-12 budget bill?
Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, this bill within the confines of the amendment if it's adopted.
Okay. So the policy issue is, I mean, the practical issue is we have to do this because in order to balance it, balance the bill, but it's only for 1 year. So ultimately, after this first temporary year, 10th graders will, the colleges will get reimbursed the same amount for 10th graders as for 11th and 12th graders.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, indeed, that's correct.
So right now, according to what Dr. Weidman told me, is it's $183 a credit. So for a three-credit course, it's roughly $550, something like that. And this would be only $85 a credit.
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, since we're crawling into some of this detail, I have a chart that I'd be willing to walk members through. Welcome to the world of K-12.
Can't you say yes to my question, Mr. Nauman?
we'll get that chart passed out here.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, I'll be happy to say yes with a proviso.
All right. Well, Mr. Chairman, I was actually curious. I really didn't know how much high schools had to pay for these college courses, and my guesstimate was it was around $300 or $400, so it's a little bit more than that. It's closer to $500, $600.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, the reason we put this chart together is to sort of unpack some of the challenges associated with the fiscal note and how it was cost estimated through the department through some ambiguity in the original language. Mm-hmm. So it addresses that question and then also attempts to show you how the formulas work and rebalance the overall bill. So I'm looking at the side that's got formula allowance in the upper left-hand corner. It says it speaks to quarter credit and semester credits in the middle of the page. And then eventually I flip you over to the other side of the page. So the statute that we have in the bill, it's 124D09, subdivision 13, has a formula for how higher ed institutions get paid when a student enrolls in PSEO. And we ultimately result in a per quarter or per semester amount, and that's the $85 that Senator Pappas was referring to. And I'll get you to that $85 pretty quickly here. But the formula has two calculations. It begins, in both cases, with the basic formula allowance that we have in K-12. In fiscal 12, that formula allowance is $51.74, and you can see that writing across the top of the page. And then it grows by $50, as we all know, in fiscal 13. There's a subtraction of $415 as step two in the formula calculation. That reflects the 415 roll-in from the 2001 legislative session, when $415 was moved off the formula allowance, or off the referendum and put onto the formula allowance. That had an effect of artificially propping up the value of the formula allowance, so we make that subtraction. Then historically, we give the higher ed institutions 88% of that value and then multiply that resulting number times 1.3. 1.3 is the pupil weight that we give to secondary students in the K-12 formula. Members that have served on K-12 will kind of nod and remember that's how the K-12 formulas work. Then for semester students, we divide that result by $30 or by 30, and for quarter students, we divide the result by 45. So you end up with numbers of total credit value along the bottom. And I'm going to concentrate on semester because that's where I think, if not all, most students are. 181 in fiscal 12, 183 in 13 and 14. And so, Senator Pappas, to your $85 question, what the department did when they estimated the cost of that provision that we're now suggesting to be amended is they reduced the weight from 1.3 to 0.6. I don't think that's what the K-12 committee intended. I think what it intended to do, Senator Pappas can correct me if I have this wrong, but is that it intended to take the result from the final calculation and multiply it times 0.6. So the difference is that you end up with $85 under the original calculation, which when you work it through the final, all the numbers on the bill, generated a savings of $14,000, as opposed to $110 in the analysis that was intended. However, that gives you a cost of $7,000. By reducing the 0.6 to 0.55, you balance the bill and we save $325. You can see how precise we've gotten here.
So that's how much per credit then?
That's the 101.
Any other questions, members?
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, yes.
Thank you.
All right, great explanation. Senator Pappas moves the A14 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. All right, further testimony on Senate File 1531. We have Roger Arison from the Minnesota School Principals. Sir, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Roger Arison. I represent the Secondary Principals Association. We're here to talk to you today about Senate File 1531. We have some very serious concerns about 1531, and we've shared those with Senator Olson in the K-12 committee. I want to talk about this a little bit, and we think there are some things in here, in fact, school principals believe that you should not do. Notwithstanding some of the discussion that you've heard from the previous speaker on this bill, this proposal significantly expands who is eligible for PSEO credits. It is not just 10th graders. You look at the bill on 1.17. This says that if someone applies, let me step back for a moment. K-12 institutions cannot apply any admission criteria for PSEO classes. The high schools cannot say you can't go. All of the admissions criteria have been applied by the post-secondary institutions. Minsky has a very standard rule, and they can tell you more about it, but if you're in the top half of your senior class or the top third of your junior class, you can participate in PSEO. What this bill says is, and if you start to look at 1.17, if you apply to be in PSEO and you are rejected, see that there? If you a student who has refused enrollment by Minsky or university under the subdivision may apply for the career or technical course. So we're going to take everybody now because they've been denied in 11th and 12th grade. In addition, we're going to look back into 10th grade under this bill and say you can take one course if you can get a C. In that course, you can take more classes. That's a significant expansion of this program, and we don't support it. Senator Olson's introduction of this in the Senate committee is correct. We need more funding in the career and technical side in K-12, and we're working on that, and we are doing some interesting things there, but we need to do more, and we'd like to do more. This bill expands the providers. This is not the same list of PSEO providers that you're used to. If you look on in the language, this says universities or colleges who are registered under 136A by the Office of Higher Education. That list, and then it goes on to say if they're eligible to receive student aid. Now, one of the problems on this bill all along has been transparency. Who is that? My own inquiries when I visited with folks in the department, they said that's everybody that's on the list at 136A. That's 136 institutions. That's far beyond what you've had that are PSEO organizations. And they will now, those institutions, will now get our K-12 funding for the students who enroll in the career and technical classes. We don't support that. Next piece on this, and Mr. Nathan made a couple of comments about freedom of speech and leveling the playing field. If you go back into the authorizing legislation here, 124D, it's pretty clear that the legislature had a paternalistic approach to the students in high schools who are going to go into PSEO. The statute says that they have to get counseling, that they actually have to talk to somebody and say, is this the right program for you? And that we actually have to have at the K-12 level, when they're in 8th through 12th grade, assemblies and information for them about PSEO. No one's keeping this a secret, and frankly, keep in mind, all these statutes were passed long before the internet. But the idea was that the lure of getting the aid money might be too great for some of the institutions, and they wanted to make sure that kids had the whole story with their parents. If you look on the websites at both the department and the Minsky institutions, there are discussions about some of the problems that kids have. Everyone isn't a success story in this. So some of the children that get enrolled, some of the students, get Fs. And a problem is that those Fs are permanent parts of their transcripts, and they can't get them off. And that does affect them later when they go to the higher ed institution. It does affect them when they're later looking for financial aid. So some of this is not roses. Finally, I want to dispel the notion in the K-12 system that we can't do things and that we can't recognize children who are very advanced. We can. We can move any eighth grader or ninth grader. We have Doogie Howsers, and we can move them up. This program is about saying that we can't say no to anybody. This has a presumption of eligibility for everyone, even if we think it's inappropriate at the K-12 system. That's for you to decide, but that model has worked very, very well. There's been some reference back to the legislative auditor's report that happened in the late 90s, and that auditor's report said this is a good program. This continues to be a good program. This expansion, we don't see that you have the resource or the data here to make this large of an expansion. And as we say, we like Senator Olson very much. We have a long-standing good relationship with her, and it is very cautiously that we disagree with her in this particular time, but we do respectfully, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, any questions for any of the testifiers? Senator Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is for Mr. Aronson. You talked about the success stories, and I'm just curious if you have a feeling for what provided success or not success for some of these students. Any evidence of what was done at the high school, whether a counselor, whether a parent, had any effect on that?
Mr. Aronson?
Mr. Chair, Senator, no question that very good counseling makes a big difference for kids on this, and you all know, and the K-12 committee knows, that we're very short of counselors in Minnesota, and there's data on that. You've all heard that. But that makes a big difference as to who's going and who's not. I think a major thing with PSEO for kids is that some kids, very consistent with what Senator Olson is saying, do better in other settings. And what we have in Minnesota is a lot of different settings that kids can go to, and I think that's a strong indicia of success as well. I would say, too, the PSEO program has done one other thing that you all know well, and that's that it made us offer college in the schools. And that's because a very large group of parents want their children staying on our campus, but they want the credits. And so that program has actually increased significantly and done very, very well. And we'd like to do that with the career and technical as well, but we need some money to do it. And so,
Senator Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to follow up, Mr. Aronson, if a student, whether they're 11th or 12th or even a 10th grader, if this bill were to pass, don't they have to go through a process of talking with their parents, talking with a counselor before they make this decision?
Mr. Aronson?
Mr. Chair, the 11th and 12th graders, it says what the statute says is that they visit with a counselor, you know, as practicable. I mean, so there are some limitations on that. But, yes, we do visit with them, yes. There's a capacity question, I think, is that if that's what you're getting to. I mean, if we, as we increase the number of kids on this, I mean, we just don't have the capacity to do it.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually think, Mr. Aronson, that the impact is going to be relatively modest. In fact, I'm kind of embarrassed, Dr. Nathan, that it's so modest. That's a joke. I'm sorry. When you look at the fiscal note, and I assume that these fiscal notes are done with a fair amount of in-depth research that people are, you know, talk to, they really only estimate that we're talking about another 100 students in grades 11 and in grade 11 and 100 in grade 12, and that must be due to the taking away the prohibition on advertising. And they only estimate 60 10th grade students that are actually going to access this opportunity. I mean, when you really talk to kids, a lot of kids say, oh, I'm taking PSCO, I'm a senior. I just talked to one at my town meeting on a Somali girl, Fati, who said, I'm taking PSCO here at St. Paul College, I'm a senior. I wish I had known about it, and I would have taken classes here as a junior because I could have gotten 2 years of college. And, you know, my family doesn't have any money, and this would be a great help for me. And she clearly was a smart girl. She attended my town meeting, so she must have been pretty smart.
Clearly.
So clearly. The other thing that I think is really a limitation on expansion here in the private sector, and the private colleges already do take post-secondary students, but they're really limited to the $183 per credit, which is approximately what Minscu charges. So they're taking a loss, the private colleges. And I don't see anyone here from the career schools in the room. Maybe there's somebody here and I'm just not recognizing them because they're hiding from me or something. Oh, hi. But I wonder if, first of all, if they would even be willing to accept these students at this rate, because they charge a lot more than this. So I think they're going to be pretty limited in how many students that they are willing to take some of these for-profit career and technical schools. So I think this is a good bill. I'm a co-author, and I don't think the sky is going to fall if we pass it, and I think it'll be wonderful to come back and see how it goes over the next couple of years.
Could Dr. Nathan respond a bit to
sure,
as well?
Sure,
I insulted him.
Dr. Nathan, please.
Mr. Chair, Senators, first, Senator Pappas, I agree with you. I wish it were broader. Robert Wadle, former Commissioner of Education, testified in an earlier committee that 5% of the youngsters in the first 5 years who participated in this program were dropouts. If it had been up to some people, those kids would never have been allowed to participate, and yet the kids had a higher grade point average than the freshman class. The Minnesota Council on Gifted and Talented has testified on four separate occasions. There are thousands of youngsters who are gifted, but they are not doing particularly well in the schools. And this is no criticism of the secondary school principals. There are different kids who learn in different ways. When we hear that this is taking our K-12 dollars, this is a decision that the legislature made 27 years ago when it said we're going to fund education for the benefit of young people, not for the preservation of a particular system. And by the way, there has been criticism by some in the colleges and universities of allowing high schools to offer post-secondary college in the schools and so on and so forth. This is the benefit of the kids. And there have been some in the colleges who've been very critical of their fellow people in colleges of education and colleges in general because they have worked with high schools to offer college in the schools. Senator, you referenced a person at your most recent town meeting. We have three youngsters who have graduated from the St. Paul Public Schools in this city. Two of them did not participate in post-secondary options. They participated in their public high school, in college in the schools, and AP and IB. Because there have been many high schools that have responded to this by increasing the number of advanced placement, international baccalaureate, and college in the schools programs. And we think that that's great. As has been testified, there's no one best kind of school for all kids. One of the things I want to remind you, again, is that a huge impact of this has been to encourage greater collaboration between high schools and colleges. That's exactly what we want to see because we want to see the best use of our limited dollars to promote collaboration, and college in the schools is a great example. One last point. The point was made that not every youngster does well in post-secondary options, and I completely agree. And the same is true, of course, and not every youngster does well in a high school. And that's why the African American Leadership Forum and Growth and Justice and the Alternative School Association in earlier testimony have said this is a really good idea to help youngsters. It's also a good idea, we have heard from some, to encourage more high schools to create the kind of terrific programs that the Mounds Park District is creating in collaboration so that youngsters, in collaboration with the Minscu system, so that youngsters will have the opportunity to collaborate and to take technical courses. That's the kind of thing that we want to encourage, greater collaboration of that kind of thing.
Thank you, Dr. Nathan. Now, looking at the clock, members, we have a couple minutes left. Are there any other questions?
Testifiers? No.
Any other questions from the committee? Anyone else in the audience wish to testify on Senate File 1531? We have one. Please, very, very briefly, please.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Darren Cordy. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Education.
Welcome to the committee.
Yes, in the interest of time, I won't rehash all of Mr. Aronson's arguments. I think that we are generally comfortable with this bill for the most part. We do want to thank Senator Olson for all our hard work on this bill. The commissioner has definitely been supportive of expanding access to PSEO opportunities and career and tech programs. The one thing that we're kind of uncomfortable with in this bill is opening up to the nonprofit private institutions. And for a lot of the things that Mr. Aronson said, that there's not that existing, we'd like to keep it to existing eligible institutions. As you know, these have shown proven track record of quality PSEO programs. And there's just no assurance right now under this bill that these new institutions would have the capacity or the ability to handle the influx in new students. And there's no guarantee that these programs would accurately assess the readiness of a student to enter PSEO. So just generally, we do support this bill. However, we would be much more comfortable under it if we're limited to institutions that are currently eligible to offer PSEO courses.
Very good. Thank you. Questions? Senator Lurie?
Thank you. I just got a couple of thoughts, and I don't mean to tie us up here, and it's just in general. And I think this bill has made a lot of progress as it's come forward. I'm really appreciative of dropping the ninth graders myself. I think that limiting to career and technical is a pretty good thing. But coming from a very rural and very remote area, PSEO has created some real problems in the districts that I represent and that I talk to. I mean, the encouraging greater collaboration, additional programming in the schools, as you mentioned, is the attempt. You know, advanced placement has been fantastic. College and the schools have been fantastic. The IB, the International Baccalaureate programs, and I think that the PSEO probably did spur some of those. And so I think that a lot of good has come from it. But for the PSEO in particular, what happens in our schools, in the ones I represent, they get pulled out, and they have to go to those remote places, and they can't make it back to the K-12 institution ever, and they're in a totally different environment. And a lot of times they're not really ready for that total immersion in the college programming. They're not there with their peers for sports, for other extracurriculars, and it's really a discouragement to our school districts to build the curriculum options for a broader set of people when we take those that are able, you know, that may or may not be able to succeed, but those most likely to be able to succeed, and pull them out and send them elsewhere. It's really, there's been some problematic dynamics, and so I understand the push, and I'm not trying to block it, but I'd like to see a little bit more work. And so I applaud some of your efforts, but I'm probably going to have to vote against this measure today, but we'll like to keep...
Senator Olson, very, very quickly,
yes,
please.
I just want to say that the challenge that we have in K-12 education is that we are a very diverse state with diverse challenges. And if an idea that will work very well in one area, if we're going to shut it down because it won't work someplace else, we've been trying to offer some diversity of those kinds of things. I want to see our schools be able to have access to some resources that we've fallen away from in our rural areas. We've got new technology coming that's capable of bringing things to our students that they've never had before. And we can't rule that out, because if we do ignore that, it may come and do it anyway, and our system is not going to be left in a very good stead. But our young people, we come first.
Absolutely.
And there clearly are differing needs, and we need to continue pursuing those options, whether it's the individualization that I brought before you before, or this, just opening this door to career tech. Some of these colleges that are involved don't have career tech programs. I mean, we're focusing on that particular aspect because that's where our resources have gone. now at the post-secondary level and have gone away from the secondary, and yet we have not maintained that bridge. The P20 partnership is talking about college and career ready, and they also recognize the importance of building these bridges. And so this is one of those ways. When Dr. Nathan came and talked to me about it, I said, bingo. You know, I'm glad he thought of it, because this is a way of opening a door for trying it. And it may not be as accessible in some areas as others, but I hope that there are others that will carry on where I leave off, that will work to assuring that we have this spectrum of availability so that these young people can thrive.
All right, Senator Pappas, Senator Lurie.
Following up on that real quick, I'm reading the committee. I think this will pass. It sounds like the administration is in favor of it, so I hope to be here and work further on making those rural options work better. But today I'm going to.
All right. Thank you. Senator Pappas moves.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move that Senate Bill 1531 as amended be recommended to pass. Or
and
is
be
it going to
referred
be,
to finance.
Be referred to finance. Okay.
Okay. Senator Pappas has a motion. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay?
No.
Motion carries.